The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
When it comes to the COVID investigation, guess who was right all along? Trump. He's been vindicated, and a lot of people have been proven wrong. Also, the heroes and villains of the COVID investigation. And Tara Reid, Biden's accuser, joins me to talk about the deep hypocrisy of the Democratic Party. This is the Dinesh D'Souza podcast.
America needs this voice. The times are crazy. In a time of confusion, division, and lies, we need a brave voice of reason, understanding, and truth. This is the Dinesh D'Souza Podcast.
There's been a massive turn in the investigation into the origins of COVID. No longer is the evidence pointing to, in fact, there never was any evidence pointing to a natural origin of COVID-19. This was a virus most likely, probably, manufactured in the Wuhan lab. By the way, with collaboration of U.S. scientists and with U.S. taxpayer money. Now, who was right about this from the beginning? Answer, Trump. Trump has been vindicated, and vindicated in a huge way, and he knows it too. Listen.
The media, the Democrats, and the so-called experts are now finally admitting what I first said 13 months ago. The evidence demonstrates that the virus originated in a Chinese government lab. Couldn't say it.
Now, one thing that is so clear is that although Trump was right from the beginning, the very fact that Trump was right drove the left into a kind of opposite position of disbelieving what Trump said and aligning with what turns out to be a kind of false consensus, a manufactured, a fabricated scientific consensus that was engineered as a public relations stunt to protect the very virologists who are making deadly viruses from having to face the music, from having to face any share of the blame. Even the Vanity Fair article, which I've now been raving about for 3 days, unexpectedly thorough and conscientious expose, nevertheless doesn't give credit to Trump. The writer just can't bring herself to do it. Here's a kind of telltale line. She goes, even though Trump is the hero of her article. Why? Because this is the guy who put the investigation on the right track from the beginning. What he said publicly has turned out to be most likely the explanation for COVID-19. So you would think they'd be like, wow, hard to believe that Trump so early called it. But no. Instead, in the article, I read this. The United States deserves a healthy share of the blame. In other words, a healthy share of the blame for the truth not coming out. Thanks to their unprecedented track record of mendacity and race baiting, Trump and his allies had less than zero credibility. So basically, the Vanity Fair writer is basically saying that, yeah, obviously, since Trump always tells lies, he couldn't be believed on this. And yet her article is a chronicle of what happens when you ignore facts, distort things, cover up things, hide things, send out instructions throughout the U.S. government not to let the truth come out, to downplay the complicity of the U.S. government in funding this so-called gain-of-function research. Let's go back to the very beginning when Trump said, when he called it the China virus. And you remember the media reaction. What would make you call it the Chinese virus? Is it really Chinese? Does it speak Mandarin? Does the virus eat with chopsticks? It's not a Chinese virus. And Trump, of course, with common sense, replied, well, it came from China. And even that was kind of a, if you think back on it, when he said it came from China, that can be taken in two ways. It just happened to come from China. But it also could imply that the Chinese gave it to us. And Trump always had that second implication. Why? Because he would talk about holding China responsible. Trump, by the way, in retrospect, was also right about the lockdowns. He's like, this stuff cannot continue. We're not going to impose long-term damage on the U.S. economy. We're going to, in a sense, learn to deal with this virus. And even on that, Trump has proven to be correct. When Trump came out and said earlier, this was in May of 2020, that he had, quote, a high degree of confidence that the virus came from a lab, he was met with universal derision, even though, as it turns out, Trump had very good sources. One of his sources, by the way, was a guy named Gao Fu, who is the Chinese director for the Center of Disease Control and Prevention. This guy in China had told Robert Redfield, by the way, the head of the CDC, himself a virologist, that the signature of the virus did not satisfy the definition or the what you'd expect from a kind of evolved naturally occurring virus. Now, I see recently that there is a report has come out that was used by the State Department under Trump. This is a report prepared in 2020 by the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. And the conclusion of this report is the virus probably came from the lab. Think about it. This is one of the most reputable research labs, Lawrence Livermore, along with Los Alamos. These are the premier both nuclear research facilities, but also chemical and biological research facilities in the world. So Trump's view is now being supported. David Baltimore, by the way, Nobel laureate, one of the most distinguished scientists in the world, says when you now look closely at COVID-19, it shows all the signatures of being a man-made virus. And then, of course, the article in the Wall Street Journal by two very prominent medical figures, one of them a former professor at UC Berkeley. And they say that COVID-19 has this unique genome sequencing combination. It's called CGG. And they say that no naturally occurring coronavirus has ever had that genetic combination. The genetic combination is extremely rare, except when it's used by scientists doing this gain of function research. And so the experts say that based on that, it is more likely than not that the virus was, in fact, man-made. By the way, if you look at the SARS virus or the MERS virus, those don't have this unique CGG-CGG combination, which suggests that those probably were naturally occurring viruses. So there is now immense scientific evidence coming from credible sources that vindicates Trump. This poor guy never gets any credit. And yet on issue after issue, when you look back, issues of immense significance, in this case, of course, an epidemic that has ravaged the world, that has destroyed the economies of many countries, that has, you may almost said, altered the global balance of power, that has killed now moving close to 4 million people. On this critical issue, from very early on, the man reviled and ridiculed as a liar, as a congenital fabricator, as a fellow who shot from the hip. This very guy, Donald J. Trump, has proven to be the most prescient voice of all. As we think about this huge emerging story of the roots of COVID-19, the story itself involves what is most likely a man-made virus done by some people doing very dangerous research, both in America and in China. And the virus gets out and begins to cause havoc worldwide. And the people involved with it get scared, and they realize that this is going to be like Chernobyl. This is going to have the same impact on the industry, on their industry, on the community of virologists, and the kind of research that they do, partly just because they can, that Chernobyl had on the nuclear industry, basically almost shut it down worldwide. And so these virologists basically create a false story. The false story is this was a naturally occurring virus. And then they go further. They employ the organs of not just the scientific community, but the health community, the World Health Organization, organs of the U.S. government, the media, the digital media, the Biden administration, they put all their forces together to lock things down and shut people up and censor them and block them and destroy the careers of people who say the opposite. And on all of this, for what? to protect their dirty little secret, to protect their lies, to protect their own direct complicity. So I want to take a moment to recognize the villains and then at the end, some unlikely heroes of this COVID investigation. Of course, the arch villain, perhaps, Bat Lady. This is the woman who probably supervised the making of the virus. Xi Zhengli in China, working, by the way, in league with the Chinese military to do it. The second villain, The Lancet. This once reputable publication, now exposed to be a kind of a fraud, or at least party to a fraud. The fraud was concocted by Peter Daszak, one of these guys who was a big investor directly involved in this so-called gain-of-function research. He's the guy who orchestrated this letter, but then tried to make sure that people who were directly involved in gain-of-function research left their names off the letter. Dr. Ralph Baric, this is the guy who runs the Eco Alliance. This is the group that is getting government money, but not just getting government money, funneling it out to other virologists and thus controlling what those virologists say. They, after all, know which side of the bread is buttered. And so they want to keep their grants flowing. And so they're willing to sign letters that say things that basically Daszak and Baric want them to say. And then we have the major media complicit in these lies, putting out the notion that anyone who says that the virus may have come from the lab, they're debunked. They're peddling conspiracy theories. So attacks on people like Senator Tom Cotton, who are trying to get to the truth. Other scoundrels, Chris Ford, the acting undersecretary for arms control and international security. This is a guy trying to suppress information about the source of the virus within the U.S. government and also telling people not to let it get out that the U.S. government was funding this kind of dangerous research. Christopher Park, the director of the State Department's biological policy staff. He basically said, do not say one word about the U.S. government's own role in gain-of-function research. So these are basically bureaucratic cover-up artists, and they need to be held accountable. The World Health Organization, which conducted this Potemkin Village bogus fact-finding trip, in which they started out with the premise, let's go find the natural source of the virus. They didn't even ask, where did the virus come from in the first place? Did it come from the lab or from the market? They assumed it occurred naturally, and so the Chinese government, knowing this, was able to manipulate the World Health Organization investigation, say, okay, well, we're only going to just look at the market. No, we're not going to give you our data from the lab. Why would you want it? You're searching, after all, for the natural source of the virus. Another culprit, now we're now getting closer to the top, on the head of the snake, Fauci, because Fauci knew that there was not only a possibility but a probability that this came from a lab, but he didn't want that to get out. So he went out publicly and said the opposite. He said, oh, the evidence shows that this was a naturally occurring virus. The thing about Fauci is he knew better. It's not that he made an honest mistake. He's a very deceitful guy. He knew there was a real debate at the very least about the source of the virus. He didn't want the public to know about that debate. So he collaborated with people like Bill Gates, Mark Zuckerberg. He was the one, in a sense, issuing instructions to digital media, and digital media was censoring millions of people who were posting, as it turns out, legitimate arguments and legitimate theories, but they were kicked off social media supposedly for promoting disinformation. And finally, both the Obama and the Biden administrations. Who facilitated this gain-of-function research? It was Obama. He's the one who allowed it to happen. He's the one who seemed to have no skepticism about the Chinese at all. Hey, yeah, let's help him out with this kind of research, even though he must have known that Chinese labs work in close working relationship with the Chinese Communist Party and the Chinese military. And finally, Biden. Biden for shutting down the Trump administration State Department investigation into the origins of COVID. So this is a pretty big rogues gallery. And on the other side, you've got the few and unlikely heroes of this COVID investigation. These are the handful of people in India, in New Zealand. It turns out from Vanity Fair, a guy working for the Bank of New Zealand who had Asperger's syndrome, but was very good in spotting data patterns. He noticed that there was something wrong. The so-called Paris group, that was a group of people on Zoom calls in Europe trying to figure out why is it that the public story about the origins of COVID-19 isn't really matching what we see in the virus. Nicholas Wade, the heroic science writer who broke this story wide open with his article in Medium, Vanity Fair, which did a great job with its expose. It provided new details and direct sources. Robert Redfield, the head of the CDC under Trump, and Mike Pompeo was heading the State Department investigation, and finally Trump itself. This is a gallery of villains and heroes. The heroes need to be commended. The villains need to be called to account. Mike Lindell is just one of the bravest guys in America and a guy who's paid a real price for speaking up, both for his political views, but also for his faith. So I've come up with the Dinesh D'Souza book deal to encourage you and give you an added incentive to support Mike Lindell. He's got great products, but I'm going to add some of my great products. Now, I haven't even mentioned this deal to Mike so far. He knows nothing about it. Here's the deal. You go all out and buy $250, $500, or $1,000 of MyPillow merchandise. It's not hard to do. This guy, Mike Lindell, has more than 100 great products. His classic premium MyPillows, the Giza Dream Sheets, the MyPillow Robes, the MyPillow Mattress Topper, the MyPillow Dog Beds you can buy for your family. You can also buy early Christmas gifts. Now, here's the fun part. If you spend $250, I'll send you a copy of one of my recent books, maybe United States of Socialism or The Big Lie, one of my favorites, personally autographed to you. If you spend $500, two signed books plus two of my movies. And if you go the full way, you spend $1,000 or more, you get four signed books and four movies, a mini Dinesh collection. So let's show Mike what we can do for him. Enjoy his great products and get some great books and movies in the bargain. Call 800-876-0227 or go to MyPillow.com and use promo code Dinesh. Now, what else do you have to do to get the books? Well, nothing. I'll get the info from the MyPillow guys and send the books to the same address that you use for your merchandise. This offer ends July 4th. Again, that number is 800-876-0227 or go to MyPillow.com to get these discounts, to get the books. You got to use promo code D-I-N-E-S-H, Dinesh. We're living in the age of the Me Too movement, but very interestingly, the Me Too label or the Me Too accusation seems to fall differently depending on who is being accused. I'm really happy to welcome Tara Reid, who has made accusations of not just sexual harassment, but sexual assault against none other than Joe Biden. And what's remarkable about this is the way that those accusations have been treated in the media. Tara, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining me. I really appreciate it. Let's start by talking about this op-ed that just came out today that you wrote jointly with Juanita Broderick. Let me start by asking you to say who Juanita Broderick is so people know who we're talking about.
Sure. Thanks for having me. I actually wrote the piece, and Juanita Broderick appeared in the video. So there's video clips of her describing what she went through. She was a volunteer on Bill Clinton's campaign when he was running for office before he ran for president in Arkansas. She was a Arkansas a nurse, I believe, and then she owned nursing homes. And she, unfortunately, was raped by Bill Clinton. And there is a deposition that has never been released from the impeachment times. It's sealed, and she has tried to have it released, but in that deposition, she describes it to Ken Starr. And her story was very, very suppressed. You do see it in some, you know, media. Katie Halper had her on the show. And similarly, Katie Halper had me on. And that was the first place I was able to come forward with a full account of the sexual assault I experienced by Joe Biden. So we talked about what it's like to be survivors and have our stories suppressed, and then watch these men, you know, go to the most powerful office in the Western world, which is the presidency of the United States. So it's called, it's a small club, and we don't want to be in it.
Now, you described in one of your press interviews your feelings when Biden was inaugurated. It must have been, talk a little bit about that. What was it like to see this guy that you have known close up, you might say, and here he is taking the oath and with all the solemnity and everybody applauding. Talk a little bit just about what that, how you experienced it.
Well, you know, it's excruciating and it's painful to hear his name so many times a day. It was when he was vice president. I had not come forward publicly at that time, but at that time I got rid of my television. I mean, that's how, you know, I just didn't want to hear his name all the time. It's really hard to quantify what it feels like to have something like that happen and try to go through protocol, which I did in 1993 to my supervisors and try to get help, be silenced and threatened. And then when you come forward in public, like I did in 2019, Edric Isaac Dovier immediately called me a Russian agent. And it scared me so badly, I didn't come out with a full account because I was getting so attacked online. And then I reached back out to the reporter at New York Times and she didn't respond. And then I reached out for months and then finally came forward with the full account of the sexual assault. So it feels like you're a ghost in your own life in some ways. It's surreal. And I'm trying to, and Juanita was very helpful in this, and we talked to each other about things that we can do, practical things in our life to help other people, to raise awareness. And that's really all we can do to move forward.
Tara, you know, let's talk for a moment about the credibility of your accusation, because this is something that you had described to at least two other people at the time that it occurred. So this is, I want to contrast for a moment your case with, let's say, Christine Blasey Ford. In Christine Blasey Ford's case, it was an accusation that went back 30 or 40 years. There seemed to be no external corroboration. Her friend that she said was there, Leland Kaiser, didn't corroborate. But in your case, there was corroboration. And moreover, unlike Christine Blasey Ford, it was kind of politically on the opposite end of the aisle from Kavanaugh. So there was a potential political motive. You were a supporter of Joe Biden, right? You worked on his staff. You've been a Democrat for most of your life. Can you explain for a moment why you think that for the very party that actually, in a sense, I wouldn't say invented Me Too, but identifies itself wholly with Me Too, how is it that someone like you has become so politically inconvenient?
Oh, you're absolutely right on every point there. The Democrats have used Me Too as a shield to shield the behavior of sexual predators. In my opinion, it's worse because, you know, Republicans, and I had a Republican friend said this to me. She said, look, we understand that our candidates are human beings. They're flawed. They make mistakes and we hold them accountable as best we can. But Democrats pretend like they're so sanctimonious. They just pretend like they don't exist. So, yes, I was a Democrat most of my life and have left the Democratic Party, obviously. The hypocrisy was astounding how I had there was a Larry King call by my mother, which was verified. And she was anonymous on the call, but had to give her name when she called in. So it was verified. There was the people that I told, my mother, my brother, and then a friend from another Senate office the day after it happened, and then another neighbor a year later. And I talked about it in very graphic terms to them so they knew. I also filed a sexual harassment report, which should be in the University of Delaware sealed files in my personnel file. And so there's even a written evidence that I was trying to get help. But the Democrats would not even look at that. And as far as Dr. Ford goes, she got a lot of support from the feminist movement or so-called feminist movement. And, you know, you can't really compare. I don't want to compare. And I'm not an investigator. So but she came forward in her own way and received all this galvanized support. When I came forward, I was virtually attacked by the same people that were supporting Dr. Ford. They weren't just ignoring me. They attacked me and attacked my reputation. And, you know, and went after me in a way that's very coordinated attacks by the media.
And, I mean, here's Tara, I have in front of me an in-depth New York Times article. I'm sure you know the one. Tara Reid's tumultuous journey to the 2020 campaign. It's a very long article. They claim to have interviewed 100 of your friends and relatives. And I'm just thinking about it, you know, nothing like this was done with Christine Blasey Ford. I mean, it must strike you that there's something really weird here in that you, the victim in this case, is being treated as if you're the perpetrator.
Absolutely. And in fact, friends that were interviewed told me that whenever they would say anything good about me, it was dismissed. They would only, if they started to talk about me in a real way, they wouldn't call them back. So they just wanted, they tried to class shame me. Like they brought up the fact that I was too poor to afford law books. This is the same party, the Democrats, that says they're for the working class. And that's what, the hypocrisy just kind of threads all the way through. The New York Times and the Washington Post are just doing the bidding of the Democratic Party. And the Washington Post is owned by Jeff Bezos. I mean, it's just, I didn't know all of this and all the threads that kind of, how information is so sifted through just a very few number of people that want us to see things a certain way. But you're right. It was unprecedented to go after me as if I was running for office. I was not running for office. Joe Biden was. You didn't see any of those articles about him, because if you did, you'd see how many times he had lied in public. You would see how many other accusers would come forward. And, all of that was buried.
Yeah. Now, Nancy Pelosi, as you know, has been introducing and continues to talk about, recently she was talking about Sexual Assault Awareness Month, and there's some legislation now coming down the pike, supposedly to protect victims of sexual assault and sexual discrimination. And my question is, what do you think when you see someone like Pelosi, posing as sort of the apostle of rectitude here, because this is someone that has absolutely refused to take your case with any seriousness at all, right?
It absolutely makes my blood boil, because she dismissed me and without even speaking to me. There's been no congressional investigation. But, I said I would go under oath. And so in 2022 or later on, if there's a change in the Congress and they decide to investigate Joe Biden, I said I would cooperate. And that definitely... It hit a note, because these are people I knew that I have met. Some of them, I had volunteered for or worked for. So it wasn't just watching the hypocrisy. It was a betrayal of my whole belief system, so to speak,
Tara, you have a book, Left Out, When the Truth Doesn't Fit. Doesn't fit in which you tell your story. And I recommend the book for people who want to hear firsthand what happened. We haven't gotten into the details, but the details are in your book. Let me ask where this has all left you. Has it influenced you? Has it made you think differently in a larger political sense? Above and beyond the personal, you said you've left the Democratic Party. Do you see yourself as an independent? Have you sort of had it with politics? How do you think of yourself now based on what you've experienced and what you've learned?
That's a good question. What's been evolving for me is that I'm an independent. So I'll vote, more about the individual and their record rather than a party. I'm not going to be involved with that any longer. And how it's shifted is that I'm going to continue to be a voice, because there are so many that are, suppressed. And there are other accusers of Joe Biden that have not been heard, and they're too afraid to come forward. I know of at least two, and that are verified. And, the way the fear is weaponized by the Democratic Party of how they'll destroy your life if you come forward is unconscionable. And so I want to make it my work to move forward. And I have a huge thanks, to give to TV Gespert for publishing my book, because I went to people for help with the book, but they were too scared of the machine, the machine by Joe Biden. So TV Gespert, Jackie Jordan, went ahead and took the risk and published my memoir. And it meant a lot to me, because it felt good to be able to, take back the narrative and say, this is my story from my perspective. And, so I would encourage survivors to come forward, be prepared to be, to have a lot of backlash if it's a powerful person. But, there are ways to do it, and, safe ways to do it. And I did it, and I feel better for it. It's better than holding a secret about a powerful man.
Tara Reid, you're a very brave person, and I'm very sorry to what you went through, but you're very courageous to speak out, and I urge other people to listen to your story. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Debbie's not exactly fond of cooking. She'll tell you that the easier the setup for her, the better. So when we got award-winning chef Emeril Lagasse's Power Air Fryer 360, all of that changed. We couldn't believe how beautiful and sleek a design it was. And the price was so reasonable, we were a little bit shocked. You gotta check it out. And if you love fried foods, like I do, Emeril's Air Fryer 360 cooks with hot air, no oil. So you can cook healthier with up to 70% fewer calories. Plus, it's faster than traditional appliances. What's the secret? Their 360-degree quick cook turbo heat technology cooks food with a whirlwind of superheated air for that great crispy fried taste without all of the added fat and calories. It also comes with many versatile accessories like a crisper tray, pizza rack, drip tray, and baking pan. And with dishwasher safe parts, the cleanup is quick and easy. Debbie especially loves cooking flatbread because it's super easy. The whole thing takes up minimal counter space, and she doesn't have to heat the whole house to do it. She hits a button, walks away, and in 20 minutes, we have our delicious flatbread. Now, right now, they have an exclusive offer just for my listeners. Go to tryemeraldair.com and use promo code Dinesh. You get 10% off plus free shipping. So head to tryemerilair.com and use our promo code Dinesh. Once again, tryemeraldair.com, code Dinesh. I want to talk in this segment about AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, her abuela, her grandmother, and conservative strategy. So this all started when AOC put out one of her classic tweets where she talks about going to Puerto Rico where her abuela was ill. And she then said, this is her home. Hurricane Maria relief hasn't arrived. And she shows a couple of pictures where apparently there's a water leak on the ground and some towels on the ground. In any case, the conservative, Matt Walsh, decided to kind of take this up. And so he started a fundraising campaign to help out AOC's abuela. Of course, he wanted to kind of expose the hypocrisy of AOC. Here's someone who's actually doing very well. She's in Congress. She has access to all kinds of money. She's got this nice apartment in D.C. So can't she help out her own abuela? Does her grandmother have to wait for the hurricane relief to arrive to basically get her apartment cleaned up? How ridiculous is this? And it turns out that this fund that Matt Walsh set up raised $100,000. Now, I'd like to commend the kind of originality of this way of thinking. I do have to point out that it's not totally original, because several years ago, when I saw on CNN that Barack Obama's brother was living in a hut in Kenya, I started my own campaign. It was called Help George Obama Move Out of His Hut. And sort of the strategic design was pretty much the same. Obama was talking about, we are brother's keeper, but obviously this brazen hypocrite was doing nothing to help his brother. I wanted to expose that, so I put up $1,000 of my own money. I raised some money to help George Obama. I eventually delivered the money to George Obama in person to improve his life. I then interviewed him for my movie. Now, with Matt Walsh raising $100,000 for AOC, very interestingly, well, here's something kind of funny. An article in The Independent, a left-wing magazine out of Britain. Right-wing blogger launches GoFundMe for AOC's Puerto Rico grandmother in latest personal attack. So they implied that raising money to help abuela is some kind of attack. There's something just absurdly comic about that. But there's also been some conservative pushback on this. Here's Julie Kelly on social media. She goes, hey, there are these January 6th protesters. These are people being locked up in solitary confinement. Instead of doing stunts, can we kind of help some people who actually need money, need legal help? Think of how far $100,000 could go. Something very interesting happened. AOC refused the money. And GoFundMe, which is the site that the money was raised on, basically says that, look, if the recipient won't take it, you have to give it back to the donors. And I guess that's what happened in the end. But let me say, in a way, that I think that AOC could have won the day. She missed an opportunity, which was she could have said to Matt Walsh, hey, Matt, very clever, my friend. You know what? I don't really need the money, but I'll take it. and I'll use the money to promote left-wing candidates, Democrats, in swing districts. So that would have been a way for AOC to kind of have the last laugh on this. So when you plan these strategic moves, they're clever, they're original. I like this, the kind of thinking that's outside the box, that exposes hypocrisy, that puts the other side up against the wall. But let's just remember, when you do it, don't do it in such a way that the money can actually be then used and deployed by the other side in a counterstrike against you. It's time to start thinking a little bit about gold. And why? Because of the state of our economy. Now, in April alone, consumer prices increased by 4.2%, the highest bump since 2008. Higher fuel prices, higher food prices, construction costs, housing prices. Hey, inflation isn't just coming, it's here. Have you protected your savings, your investments? If you haven't yet diversified a portion into precious metals, the obvious answer is no. Now, for years, actually decades, I never invested in gold, just the stock market. But now I'm seriously worried about the regime we have in Washington. Look at these crazy guys. No sense of fiscal responsibility. So listen, if all your investments are tied to greenbacks, you're sitting on a bit of a ticking time bomb. You might want to invest a portion of your savings into gold and silver. Birch Gold Group is who I purchased from and who you can trust to convert an IRA or eligible 401k into an IRA backed by gold and silver. That's right. Through a little-known tax loophole, you can convert your retirement savings tied to the stock market into an IRA backed by precious metals. It's your hedge against inflation. Text Dinesh to 484848 for your free information kit on precious metals IRAs, or to speak with a Birch Gold representative today. With 10,000 customers, an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau, and countless five-star reviews, Birch Gold can help you too. Text Dinesh to 484848 and invest in gold and precious metals like I did before it's too late. How did the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, an organization founded to promote free speech and civil liberties, and to protect free speech and civil liberties, how did an organization like that become a deadly enemy of free speech and of civil liberties? The New York Times recently, in a pretty good article by Michael Powell — the Times these days is erratic, most of its articles are just garbage — but this is an article, the kind the Times will occasionally publish, that is an examination. They caught up with a guy named David Goldberger. And David Goldberger, who is now in his 70s, almost 80, he was the one who argued on behalf of the ACLU to let the Nazis march in Skokie. For those of you who don't know, Skokie, a heavily Jewish neighborhood in Illinois, the Nazis wanted to march there. The Jews obviously protested. They said, this will be very traumatic. We've got Holocaust survivors who live here. But the ACLU was, you may say, absolutist in its view of free speech, that people have a right to speak. And as long as the speech is legal, government cannot restrict it. They can't shut it down. And David Goldberg, who argued that case, tells the New York Times the ACLU is different now. He's disappointed in the organization. He says, quote, "Liberals are leaving the First Amendment behind." Now, David Goldberg is not alone. Ira Glasser, the former head of the ACLU, says that, look, the ACLU is now trying to be some kind of left-wing group that promotes racial justice and immigrant rights and transgender issues. And he goes, but there's only one ACLU that used to be a content-neutral defender of free speech. He goes, I fear we're in danger of losing that. Now, this is all understatement. What he means is, I fear it's gone. We can't count on the ACLU anymore. Nadine Strossen, New York University Law School professor, former head of the ACLU. Nadine Strossen is a consistent defender of free speech. She knows, and she said publicly, that the ACLU has abandoned its core cause. Now, there have been free speech battles. We're living in a time where free speech is gravely endangered in this country. In fact, quite frankly, you and I don't have it. Not only are we censored regularly by digital platforms, restricted in all kinds of places, but we end up censoring ourselves in order not to be kicked off these platforms, which are now the public square of American public, of American political discourse. And it isn't just digital platforms. The free speech debate involves public schools where you can't say what you believe, in campuses where you are hauled up on charges or you violate a speech code or you're brought in by the dean or there's a demonstration to have you expelled because you said something that ran athwart of contemporary orthodoxies. Corporate America just become just as regimented in stifling free speech, and then government institutions. And so this is a problem across the board. There's almost no American who's safe here. And at one time, if you were expelled from your job, or you were censored by the government, or you were shut down, you could go to the ACLU. And the ACLU would say, hey, listen, we may detest your politics. You may be some kind of an extremist or a right-winger or this or that, but we have a principled commitment to free speech. And this is the point about these rights, is that either you defend them on principle or you don't believe in them at all. It was Anthony Lewis, the New York Times writer, many years ago, in writing about, in a somewhat different context, when he's talking about civil liberties, he says that our civil liberties are often protected in cases that involve some not so nice people, people who are criminals who nevertheless have a right to criminal representation, in other words, to a due process of law defense, people who say ugly things, but nevertheless, their rights need to be protected. Why? Because by protecting free speech at its extreme, you make speech safer, more protected for the rest of us. But you can't count on the ACLU to do that. Part of the reason appears to be this guy, Anthony Romero, who is the first, quote, person of color, and apparently a race justice activist. He's, by the way, also gay, and so he's become a fanatic transgender guy. And so there's a new mood at the ACLU. They're happy to repress speech, to take the side of the bad guys. Recently, a transgender ACLU lawyer startled even some traditional ACLU supporters who remember the ACLU's fights against book banning and censorship. He's talking about a book on transgender rights, which he doesn't approve of. And this transgender lawyer says, stopping the circulation of this book and these ideas is 100% a hill I will die on. Wow. This is a person saying not only that they want to repress the book, but they're willing to go to the mat for it. They're willing to sort of put their life on the line for it. The ACLU has raised a lot of money in being a kind of anti-Trump organization. And so it appears like they've drifted from being a free speech organization and a civil liberties organization. I mean, they don't protect, it's not just free speech. The Trump administration wanted to give greater protections for people accused of sexual harassment on campus, greater protections for the accused. Now, this is a cause that the ACLU used to be on top of, protecting the accused because they might be falsely accused. But no, the ACLU basically attacks the Trump administration, says don't protect the accusers. This promotes an unfair process, inappropriately favoring the accused. And then in the Makia Bryan case, where you remember the cop whom had to make a split-second decision facing a black girl with a knife in the process of stabbing another black girl, the ACLU tweets, Columbus police murdered a 15-year-old black girl. Think about it. There's been no trial, there's been no conviction, no evidence, and yet here's the ACLU in a criminal justice case where at one time they would have been very solicitous of the rights of the accused, but now the guilty, presumed guilty, guilty until proven innocent. So this is the new ACLU. It's a national disgrace. Far from being an organization that we can respect and support, it is an organization that deserves our condign and appropriate contempt. I want to talk to you about a cleaning product that works kind of like, well, kind of like magic. If you're thinking of replacing your carpets due to pet stains and odors, you got to try Genesis 950. The reviews are unbelievable. This is one product that actually works. With water, it breaks down the bonds of stains and odors so they are gone for good. Its antibacterial component removes pet odors from carpet and padding. It can be used in a carpet cleaning machine, and it's green, so it's safe for your family and pets. Genesis 950 is made in America. One gallon of industrial strength Genesis 950 makes up to 7 gallons of cleaner. But Genesis 950 is also great for bathrooms, floors, upholstery, and grease stains. Debbie uses it to clean the entire kitchen. When I got chocolate on my pants and on the couch, Genesis 950 took it right off. Genesis 950 has great customer service. Order 1 gallon direct at genesis950.com. You'll get a free spray bottle, free shipping, and a $10 coupon code using the code Dinesh. That's genesis950.com. The coupon's only available for 1 gallon purchase. Genesis 950, it's much cheaper than replacing your carpets or your pants or your couch. I'm back with the other D'Souza, Deborah D'Souza. With your new look,
Deborah.
You've got Deborah. You've got
my mom calls me Deborah.
Hey,
when she's mad.
You've got the short haired look, which is probably not what people are used to.
I like it.
It looks really cool.
It's better. Yeah.
It looks awesome. Well,
thank you, honey.
Debbie and I were having our lattes.
Thanks for noticing. A month later,
honey. Don't be ridiculous.
Just kidding.
Anyway, we were watching, while we were sipping our lattes, this video from Kamala Harris. And she's kind of a surprising video in which she's apparently telling people not to come. Let's take a quick look and then we can talk about it. Listen.
I want to be clear to folks in this region who are thinking about making that dangerous trek to the United States-Mexico border. Do not come. Do not come.
You think she's been possessed by Trump? I mean, what the heck is going on here? What? How do you explain what she's trying to do? It's a complete about-face from her earlier position
right. And
the whole Biden administration's position,
right. Which
was, please come.
Well, I think, they see the crisis that they have created, and they don't want to take blame for it. So they want to come across to say that they indeed do not endorse it, right? Kind of like when I was a teacher and I would talk to my class and I would say, listen, I don't want you to talk, during class. I don't want you to do this. I don't want you to do that. And hold them to it and then exit the classroom and expect for them to sit there and do nothing, right?
Which they obviously wouldn't.
Oh, no, of course not. The teacher went out of the room and they had a party. Well, it's kind of the same.
So you're saying basically that Kamala Harris, that they've put out the message all across Central America.
Absolutely.
It's okay to come. And now as a strategic posture.
Correction. Central and South America.
Yeah. Hey, talk about a little bit about your cousin, because you've been talking to him in Venezuela. And describe what that's all about.
Well, my cousin, who is, as you know, very industrious, he by degree is a mechanical engineer, really, really smart guy. I feel so horrible for him because he has put up with this insanity for many, many years. Right after he graduated college, Hugo Chavez really started, toppling down Venezuela and started going, socialist, basically. So his entire adult life has been, he's in his 40s now. So right after he was out of college in his 20s is when the reality of this nightmare started to unfold for him. So he's been very crafty in his survival. As we shared a couple of years ago when they would have all those outages because of the infrastructure being so old in Venezuela, he would make his own generator and he'd go off in the mountains and he would camp out for a few days until electricity came back and he would literally survive with his homemade generator. So very, very smart guy. But lately, I think the toll of this nightmare has taken a toll on him. And so he reached out not too long ago and said, hey, I'm thinking of crossing the border. And I was like, you mean the Venezuela border? He was like, no, the Mexican border. Because word on the street in Venezuela is that Joe Biden, once you get through the Rio Grande, he will grant you, status. And
let you stay.
And let you stay. Yeah. So all these Venezuelans think all they have to do is get to Mexico and then they can cross the border.
Well, they're kind of right.
So,
we'll come back to your cousin in a moment, but here's an article 10,864 Venezuelans pour into Texas border region. That's this year. Last year, 135. So policy exactly. has consequences. And these are Venezuelans. Now, they talk here about a woman. They say she was a photographer back home, and she came with her professional Nikon camera equipment. So these aren't, you know, campesinos who are coming to do construction work or work in the fields. You have educated Venezuelans, but socialism has choked not just the lower class, but the middle class. And in desperation, they've now got the word that they can cross the Rio Grande. When they do, the Border Patrol grabs them and then lets them go, gives them a court date, but essentially releases them into the country.
Yeah, exactly.
And this is Biden. This is exactly. what Biden. So to come back to your cousin. What did you tell him? And how do you see the situation? What should he do?
I told him not to do it. I said it's too dangerous. And he himself said, you know, the only thing that's keeping him from doing it is he doesn't want to be a criminal. He doesn't want to be caught by ICE and given a summons and telling him
put into a facility.
He doesn't want to do any of that because he's never committed a crime in his life and he doesn't want to start now. But he's desperate. He has gotten to the point where he cannot survive. And these are middle class people. These are people that had money at one point and that would never, ever imagine that they would be so desperate as to swim a river for freedom. But you know, Dinesh, freedom is the same in every country. And when the government runs your life, that chokes the freedom right out of you. So, you know, when people come to this country and then expect the government to take care of them, what are they doing? They're doing the exact same thing. They're voting for policies or supporting policies that made their country a hellhole.
Now, right? you told your cousin, you said, hey, you know why the Biden people are doing this.
Right.
It's political cynicism. It's they're hoping to, in a sense, be importing in future Democratic voters. Now, your cousin knows all that. How does he make sense of the situation from his side?
Right. Well, he says, you know, unfortunately, you know, when you know, a lot of the people coming to America via this route were Trump supporters. But Trump did not allow this. Trump would not allow this. So they are taking advantage of the situation because they know that this administration wants illegals for purposes of who knows what, pandering and then later becoming voters if they go the citizenship route, which, by the way, I'm glad that the Supreme Court actually did something that will prevent that from happening anytime soon. But nevertheless, they do it because they think they can. And once they get here, you know, I have to just kind of give you a little bit of background. Some of these people coming through the border were Chavistas. In other words, they supported Hugo Chavez and Maduro in Venezuela, the socialist route.
So in other words, they helped create the socialist nightmare that they're now fleeing from.
Exactly. But they didn't realize that socialism was not equality for all. See, they didn't know that. They didn't realize that they had to be in the top elite group in order to actually take advantage of all the goodies, you know. They didn't realize that it was going to be misery for all. They misunderstood that, right? So when they realized it, they were like, wow. Unfortunately, some of these Chavistas come here and they're okay with the leftist ideology, the Marxist ideology. They don't realize that these people are under the same umbrella.
You're saying the left here and there is cut from the same cloth.
Exactly, cut from the exact same cloth. They believe in the exact same thing. And so they don't realize that coming here and being a part of the Democratic Party is essentially doing the same thing that they did in Venezuela.
I mean, you've skirmished on social media with leftist Venezuelans who say, well, Venezuela's horrible and Chavez is horrible, but that's not what the left and the Democrats are doing in this country. And you're like...
Exactly. That is what I try to tell them is that, you know what, it is the exact same thing.
It might take
it only took them 20 years It might take us 40 years, but at the end, I think that, you know, socialism is socialism. And as I've told you before, I have some friends in Venezuela that live high on the hog. They're not starving, but my family is. And so I look at them, I try to tell them, don't do it, don't go over, you know, don't cross the Rio Grande for freedom. Let's do it the correct way. I'm trying to see if I can get an immigrant attorney to help my cousin so that he can come to America. But you have to realize a lot of these Venezuelans coming to America aren't coming to America because they think America is great and they want to be Americans. They're fleeing.
They're refugees.
The catastrophe that is their home country that they wish was not the case.
So they're, in other words, they'd happily go back if there was an opening up in Venezuela.
Absolutely. If Venezuela was free again, free of this nightmare that Maduro, that Hugo Chavez and now Maduro is perpetuating and causing, I think that they would be happy to live in Venezuela.
And so your position, and mine too, is that your cousin is the kind of immigrant that actually America will benefit from. He's an educated guy. He's hardworking. You mean he's conservative in his convictions, but all we're saying to him is, hey, we'll try to help you come the legal way.
Right, exactly. He hates big government, as people should. And you know, you had Tara Reid a little while ago talking about how she votes for the person. Unfortunately, the people that are under the umbrella of the political party believe in the ideology of the political party. So you have to be very careful that you don't vote for a person that will then turn around and essentially vote for socialism.
Politics is fought in teams.
Exactly.
There's a team that's on one side and there's a team that's on the other side.
Exactly.
Okay, terrific. Really enjoyed this and wow. What a story.
Very sad, but the reality.
The reality of it, yes. I want to recommend to you a movie that is both inspiring and moving. Now, for many Americans, Father's Day is a day to celebrate. For many others, though, it's a day to get through. Why? Because Father's Day hurts if you don't have a father. Now, the facts are really clear. Fatherlessness drives many bad outcomes in America, from teen pregnancy to incarceration. An astounding 85% of youths in prison come from fatherless homes. That's 20 times the national average. But there is a path forward from the grim statistics, and this is why I urge you to order a powerful new film. It's called The Streets Were My Father. Now, this movie features the journey of three inner-city Chicago men from fatherlessness to gangs, and from life in prison to prison ministry programs that set them on the road to redemption and lives as productive members of society. Here's a short clip. Listen.
I desired to have a father who would tell me that what I did was wrong.
Debbie and I watched this together. At times we had tears in our eyes. To see this important and inspirational film, the streaming version, or to get DVDs, go to salemnow.com and buy a copy, or buy copies. It's perfect for someone you know who doesn't have a father or doesn't believe in the power of God to change lives. Go to salemnow.com, that's salemnow.com, and order this great movie. I want to talk about the corrupting influence of Hollywood, not just at home here in America, but also abroad. Now, many of us are familiar with the toxic, demented, depraved, just downright sick themes in a lot of Hollywood movies. This has now become, you may say, the Hollywood norm. And it reflects the twisted, depraved lives of the people in Hollywood, the people who write and direct these movies. I'm always relieved and happy that I can make movies while having nothing to do with Hollywood. But Hollywood isn't just a menace at home. It is also a menace around the world. Why? Because it spreads a toxic and destructive message. And it gives a bad name to America all over the world. Many people look at America and they go, oh, I hate American culture, but they don't hate America. What they mean is they hate the kind of America that Hollywood puts onto the global stage and onto the global screen. My mom, for example, you know, now passed away, but when she was alive, she'd talk about what kind of disgusting messages that she was seeing in American TV shows and movies. And I would have to explain to her, Mom, that's actually not America. That's not the way that most Americans or many Americans live, but that is Hollywood's America. That is the America that you see and that you respond to with kind of appropriate revulsion. Now, I wrote about some of these themes in a book that I published several years ago, a controversial book, not just on the left, but also on the right. It was called The Enemy at Home, The Cultural Left and Its Responsibility for 9/11. Let me say a word or two about the themes in that book, because at that time there was a sort of idea on the right, an idea put out by scholars like Bernard Lewis and Samuel Huntington, that there was a clash of civilizations between the West and the Muslim world. It was sort of us against them. And we were, at least in the aftermath of 9/11, we were the good guys and the Muslims were the bad guys. Now, I said, look, there's some truth to this, of course, but it's also too simple. Why? Because there's a division inside of America. Who's us? There's the left and there's the right. And similarly, there's a division in the Muslim world. Who's them? Yes, we're talking about the radical Muslims, but the radical Muslims aren't the only Muslims over there. There are also, I said, well, not liberal Muslims, there aren't too many liberal Muslims, but there are traditional Muslims. And so you don't have two parties here, you have four. And I noticed something early on that is now very obvious, but at the time was less obvious, that the radical left in this country is allied with, works in cahoots with, the radical Muslims over there. Now, when I first said this, there were a number of even conservatives who recoiled and said, what do you mean, Dinesh? Are you implying that the permissive left in America is somehow working with the illiberal forces of radical Islam? And I said, yes, that is what I'm implying. They have a common enemy, and that common enemy isn't just traditional Islam, but it's also traditional conservatives in America. Now, today, as I say, that kind of alliance is obvious. Think of someone like Rashida Tlaib or Ilhan Omar. They're in both camps. They're radical Muslims on the one side, and yet they're on the radical left at the same time. They embody this alliance, if you will, themselves. And the point I was trying to make in that book, The Enemy at Home, was that we might find some common ground with traditional Muslims, at least on so-called moral issues. Now, one of the arguments in The Enemy at Home is that Hollywood and the left were putting a very depraved picture of American culture abroad, one that was being exploited by the radical Muslims. When bin Laden called America, as many Muslims do, the Great Satan, you must remember that in the Bible, Satan is not a conqueror. Satan is a tempter. Satan is a seducer. And basically what bin Laden and his friends were saying is, hey, traditional Muslims, you should join us, the radical Muslims. Why? Because we got to strike out against these sick, demented, depraved people in America who are spreading their toxic ideas, their values that are really anti-values, their depravity that is corrupting the innocence of our children, destroying our families, and ruining our cultures. So this is how the radical Muslims took advantage of the cultural left and used it as a recruiting mechanism in their own country. So this, I think, is the toxic influence of Hollywood. But what I want to talk about in the next segment is a very interesting way in which this toxic culture of Hollywood is now corrupting the once wholesome culture of Bollywood. Who doesn't need more sheets? For your room, for the kids' room, for the guest room, just for spares. Now, Mike Lindell has come out with the world's most comfortable bed sheets. He found the best cotton in the world. This is in a place where the Sahara Desert, the Nile River, the Mediterranean Sea all come together to create the perfect ideal weather conditions for growing cotton. His new Giza Dream bed sheets are made with this long staple cotton. They're going to be the most comfortable sheets you'll ever own. Debbie and I can attest to that. The first night you sleep on these MyPillow sheets, you'll never want to sleep on anything else. The Giza Dream sheets are available in a variety of colors, like all of Mike's products, 60-day money-back guarantee, and 10-year warranty. Now, right now, you can buy one, get one free by calling 800-876-0227 and use promo code Dinesh. Remember, if you buy $250, $500, or $1,000 of Mike Lindell's merchandise, you get additional free books and movies straight from Dinesh. For a limited time, buy one, get one free on the sheets. Look at all the other great products. Call 800-876-0227 or to go to MyPillow.com to get the discount, to get the books. Make sure to use promo code Dinesh. I want to talk in this segment about Hollywood and Bollywood. Now, I grew up in a suburb of Bombay called Bandra, and right around the corner from my house is a studio. It's called Mehboob Studio, and a lot of Bollywood films are made there. And I grew up watching both English movies, Western movies, and of all kinds, war movies, and so on. But I also grew up watching Bollywood films. And of course, educated Indians always laugh at Bollywood because there's a certain absurd character to the plots, which are exaggerated. The heroes can all jump from the ground floor to the third floor. They're seemingly invincible. They're sort of superheroes before the invention of the superhero. There's ridiculous dancing around the trees. And so there's this kind of, you may almost say, caricature view of life. Bollywood films are notoriously escapist, but let's remember that they serve an escapist function for tens of millions of poor Indians whose lives are hard, it's a daily grind, and so the Bollywood movies were a way to get away from all that, to live, you may say, in a kind of acknowledged fantasy world. But there's a change that's going on in Bollywood that I want to talk about. One of the most popular Bollywood films of the past, quarter century, it's called Dilwale Dulhania Le Jayenge. It's basically about how the brave man kind of wins the beautiful bride. And you have the story about this guy who is a guy who's courting this Indian girl, but she is the daughter of an immigrant shopkeeper, and she's actually been committed in an arranged marriage to marry some other guy. And so our hero has to disguise himself and show up to the family and pretend to be somebody he's not and slowly woo the family and woo the daughter. But eventually, they kind of find out who he is and they say, sorry, this is not going to work. And so the family, when the daughter begs her parents to be able to go off with the hero, finally the parents say, listen, guys, if you're going to do this, you have to elope. You have to secretly take off. We can't do this in public. We're going to know about it, but we're not going to say anything about it. But in a very interesting twist, the hero of the film goes, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to elope. I'm not going to sort of secretly run off. I'm an honorable Indian, and being an honorable Indian means we acknowledge and respect the family. I need the parents' public blessing to go ahead, and if I can't get it, I'm out of here. And so you have the kind of closing scene of the movie where the guy's at the train station, he's about to board, and at the last minute, of course, the parents show up with the daughter, and there's this kind of tearful parting, and of course she marries the good guy, and they live a happy life together. Now, this is sort of old Bollywood, traditional plot, slightly implausible, a little ridiculous, but nevertheless, it's celebrating, you may say, honorable values, values of romance and love, but at the same time, the importance of tradition, the importance of patriotism, the importance of living, you may say, by a code of honor. Now, Bollywood is changing a little bit, and it's changing really because it's being influenced more by Hollywood. How did this happen? Because the old family studios, which were run by kind of Indian industrial families, is now being taken over by kind of younger Indians who have now set up international networks. They often get their money abroad. They work in cahoots with studios like Warner Brothers and Sony and Paramount and Foxstar and Walt Disney. And so what's happened to the Bollywood movie now is it hasn't completely lost its old feel. But now you've just got a lot of technical glitz and a lot of very modern dance routines and a lot of psychedelic lights. But if you ask, what does any of this have to do with the story? The answer is pretty much nothing. So what you have is, and this has happened in Hollywood as well, is that Hollywood technically has gotten a lot better. If you contrast, for example, a film like Titanic with a old film like The Poseidon Adventure, Titanic is made much better. The scenes of the natural catastrophe, the iceberg hitting the ship are incredible. The scene of the ship plummeting into the ocean is incredible. A Poseidon Adventure can't do that. But if you're looking for character, you're looking for plot, you're looking for some underlying lessons about life, you're looking for a certain inspirational quality, then there's no comparison. Poseidon Adventure is 20 times better than Titanic. And the same is true with Bollywood. Bollywood is moving, you may say, in the Hollywood direction. And the result is films that just aren't as good. Here's a Bollywood director, Dave Benegal. He goes, Bollywood knows its audience. The people who love Hindi films, no matter where they are, meaning in India or in the Middle East, wherever, they don't want American-style stories with sex and violence. What they want are the ingredients that once defined classic Hollywood. Beautiful stars, lavish costumes and settings, singing and dancing, strong emotions, melodrama, and most important, a very clear and simple moral lesson. That was the old Hollywood. That was the old Bollywood. But I think it is a great loss for the movies that we are now moving, not only here, but also there, away from all that.
Subscribe to the Dinesh D'Souza podcast on Apple, Google, and Spotify, or watch on Rumble, YouTube, and SalemNow.com.